please call the roll?
Board Member Flores?
Excused.
Board Member Goff?
Just rotate around here. You can call her name again.
We'll go those two later.
Pass.
Board Member Mesnick?
Pass.
Board
here.
Member Rankin?
Here.
Board Member Sheffel?
Here.
Board Member Schroeder?
Here.
Chairman Durham?
Present, and just keep the roll call open.
Keep it rolling.
We'll pretend we're in the Senate for a minute. You know what they call a member of the Senate who's on time?
What?
Lonely. yes. Would you care to answer present?
Just sit here. Board
Member Present. Perfect. Okay. Quorum is present. We're going to proceed this morning with the first item 3.01, content exams for educational licensure endorsements, and Commissioner, who's going to handle?
You're on the wrong agenda.
It is.
Oh, yeah. Did you change? Oh, you changed the agenda.
Yeah, we've moved things around.
Oh,
so
we're doing
3.01.
One moment,
folks. Yes, the content exams.
Gotcha.
Let's see.
We've got King.
You read number two.
So who's going to?
Dr. O'Neill.
Dr. O'Neill. Perfect.
Share all kinds of information with us.
We'll share all kinds. So good morning. This is Colleen O'Neill. I'm the Executive Director of Educator Preparation, Licensing, and Educator Effectiveness. And I am here today to just give you an informational item around content assessments. If you think back, 20 years, but really two, and the last couple of years, I came forward to...
I was a baby then.
You, Dr. Flores
yes.
Present.
I mean, everybody started when they were five, so it worked out. But yes, 2 years ago I came to the Board of Education and I talked about a couple of things that the stakeholders across Colorado were asking for. One, they were asking for a rule alignment with our Colorado Educator Preparation and Licensing Standards to ensure that they were aligned with the current initiatives, including things like SB 191 and Educator Effectiveness and our Colorado Academic Standards. The Board of Education approved that rule alignment in January of this year. At the same time that folks were asking us about ensuring that those rule alignments were there, they were also asking us to review our content assessments that identify competency in all of our endorsement areas for our license. So math competency, social studies competency, English, elementary, all of those competencies. And we said we will absolutely begin that because that is an immediate need as soon as the rules were approved. So we did that. The rules went live on the Secretary of State's website at the end of March. Literally the next week, we had amassed a stakeholder group across Colorado to start to review the content assessments. And so that is what I just wanted to give you an update on today. We have fast-tracked it based off of folks' request in the field. Right now, we have two content assessments that are approved by the board. They are The Place, which is administered by Pearson, and there are some Educational Testing Service, ETS or Praxis 2, assessments that are also approved by the Board of Education. Our stakeholder group has asked us to come forward to the board with a recommendation for a revamp of those assessments. The primary reasons for that are, one, PLACE is offered right now pencil and paper still three times across the state of Colorado. That is really onerous for our educators to get to and to participate in. So we are fast-tracking it to try to alleviate some of that. The second one is to ensure, of course, that our content assessments are fully aligned with our educator preparation and licensing rules and our Colorado academic standards. Within that, we need to ensure that they are reliable, they are valid, and that they are an appropriate measure of what we expect our teachers to know and be able to do in a classroom for our kids with regard to content. In order to do that, we fast-tracked it with the stakeholder group. We have a co-chair. We have co-chairs. I guess you don't have a co-chair. You have eight co-chairs. And one is an Educator Preparation Institute representative. The other one is a human resource representative from the district. They are chairing those. That stakeholder group has come together three times now under what we did was a response for information to the two largest content assessment testing agencies. The first one, of course, is Pearson and the National Evaluation System. The second one is the Educational Testing Services. We sent out in early April, as soon as those rules were approved, we sent out a request for information from those two entities, amassed our stakeholder groups, had those testing agencies conduct basically a reliability and a crosswalk measure of what our standards and our Colorado academic standards and our licensing standards set, identify where all of those connections were between their assessments, over 40 assessments, content assessments for us. And the stakeholders are now involved in reviewing that, being presented with that information, digging in very deeply and asking critical questions. They are tasked, and they chose this task within 2 months' time frame in June to basically be able to come back to the Board of Education with a recommendation from that stakeholder group as to how to proceed with our content assessments. In June, we are anticipating that it could be an adoption moment, or it could just be an informational moment for the board, meaning this stakeholder group is going to come back and say, we have reviewed all 40 content areas. We have dug in deeply to identify the crosswalk between those content areas. We have identified a single provider or potentially multiple providers that can ensure that we have valid and reliable assessments that meet the needs of our Colorado educators, that are available nationally and internationally in an online format, so they are not taking a pen and paper, pencil and paper assessment in the state of Colorado, and that they are aligned with the expectations of rigor set forth by the Board of Education in the Educator Preparation and Licensing Standards. That was a lot of information, but I wanted you to know that we have fast-tracked it purposefully so that we did not have to sit for another year with just three assessments windows for our teachers to come in and take content assessments.
Ms. Masnick.
Excuse me, did you say one of those tests is only available by pencil and paper three times a year?
So I don't really love to answer this question, but I'm going to, because right now that is actually how our place assessments are administered, pencil and paper, three times a year, the vast majority of them. That's it. Several of them are also administered through test windows online through the Educational Testing Services or Praxis 2. But almost all of our place right this second are administered pencil and paper.
But are you saying it's not available online? Or it's just most, is that because they only offer the testing?
That place test right now, as it stands, without the adoption of a new assessment, is only available in paper and pencil. Hence the reason we're fast-tracking it after the rules became available. It is when I say it is onerous for our educators, it is onerous for our educators. So yes, that is what they're dealing with today. And hence the reason, as soon as the rules were adopted and we knew that we had a streamlined event, we were like, how quickly can we move on that and still be incredibly deep?
Dr. Shuffle.
So how many tests are they reviewing?
Absolutely.
For alignment?
There are approximately, it's about 40. It's about 40, and they, again, we had the testing companies do a crosswalk of those to ensure that their standards and what they were testing were meeting our standards and what we expect our teachers to know. So it is approximately 40 today. There are some that are not on the plate today, and my example is culturally and linguistically diverse, because that is by program endorsement only. There is not a content assessment today that actually aligns with that.
And so are they aligning with the student standards, or which standards?
We've actually asked them to crosswalk both of them. So the Colorado academic standards in addition to our teacher preparation and licensing standards, and ensure that crosswalk exists. And again, these are content only. This is not a pedagogical test. And I think that's important to know. So we are testing the depth of content knowledge in these assessments.
And who's on the committee that will bring the recommendations?
Absolutely. And I apologize that I didn't bring, but I will forward you the exact committee list. Right now, we have approximately 15 members, and they range from educators, teachers in the classroom, to deans of education for educator preparation entities. We have HR representation. We have the Colorado Association of School Personnel Administration representation. We have representation from the Colorado Consortium of Deans. So there's a pretty strong crosswalk there on the stakeholder group. We also have very clear individuals that have assessment backgrounds, deep assessment backgrounds, at an Institute of Higher Education level.
And I would only just say, as you're advising this group, are you going to these meetings? Or
I am. So I will leave here and head to the next one that's happening today.
So I would just say, as you guide their work, I would just ask for options, because this is a high-stakes assessment, and some students struggle to get through this test. Most don't. But there are some students that do, and if they only have one test, one gate, they must pass it to get their license. Then, you know, there need to be options. So I think for those kinds of students, having the place or the praxis and options is really helpful. They only have one option. Sometimes it's difficult because of the format of the test.
Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Schroeder.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me there's been some controversy about the science assessments, because they're so broad, and in fact, especially for secondary teachers, they actually tend to specialize, and so they're being tested in areas that they had back in junior high.
I see. Dr. Schroeder, that's a great question, and it's something that's bubbling up more and more, and I think you'll see me in front of you next fall or early spring asking for potentially a variation in our endorsement models again. Several years ago, we had individual endorsements in biology, individual endorsements in middle school, all of those. From a rural perspective, that was very difficult for folks to really say, okay, I just need a biology teacher at a rural. I don't. I need a 7 through 12 or 6 through 12 science teacher. So I need that endorsement ability. And so we collapsed those endorsements, and I apologize for not knowing the year. I want to say it's in the early 2000s, like 2003-04, we collapsed those endorsements, got away from individualized endorsements, really pulled away from middle school endorsements as well. And so in the last year, we have definitely heard folks coming back and saying, you know what, we actually really do want to see a middle school endorsement in science, or we want to be able to see a science endorsement in just biology or in just physical science. Same thing with our math. And so we're starting the conversation again. It's about alignment right now, and then starting the conversation about educator licensing and endorsement, maybe 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. I'm not sure what number we'd be on, but that would be the next conversation, because I do really think that there is a strong need in the field to have that differentiation. As long as it's not pushed down to them from a hiring perspective, at that point, they're like, don't make me hire just a biology teacher. Allow me to hire my 6 through 12 science-endorsed teacher, but allow folks to really specialize if that's the case, so that if I am at DPS, I can specialize. So that is opening up the conversation, and again, I think we'll be back having that conversation with the board either late fall or early spring.
For how many subjects is that an issue? You just mentioned math, so apparently there's some specialization in math.
I did. I actually will tell you that it depends on who you talk to. There is definitely a math specialization. There's a science specialization. There is STEM specialization as well in different areas across that. We are also looking at potentially some elementary education, early childhood specializations, where there's been some conversation. Lots more digging to do, but some conversation around our early childhood and the overlap of early childhood and elementary, and whether that is truly the best way to help our kids from a teaching endorsement standpoint and a professional standpoint. So I think those are probably our biggest areas.
So this creates the challenge for rural districts, actually for all districts, in schools, in moving teachers, keeping a teacher, but having them teach at a different level, first grade or kindergarten versus fifth grade.
Specializations could prevent them.
So finding some ways to speed up those differences. Or what are the pieces that are significantly different between the levels in order to help schools be able to have that flexibility? Because kids don't come in set numbers. 1 year, you're going to have three rounds of first grade, another year you're going to have two. Those kinds of things. So then you've got to have some flexibility in where you place your teachers. If it's just grade 1 and 2, that's not a big deal, but it can sometimes be kind of dramatic because of economic, well, whatever reasons, that the kids' numbers really change.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Yes, Dr. Flores. Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Rankin was next, and then Dr. Flores.
Thank you for the report. You did have a lot of information, but it sure answered a lot of questions that I've had. Could you answer another one? Praxis is put out by ETS, is that correct?
Correct.
So PLACE is put out by
Pearson. Okay. And PLACE, just to clarify, PLACE was made for Colorado only. It was an RFP. It's Colorado only. We are not headed down that path today. That was a large chunk of money that went to the development of that. But Pearson also works with the National Evaluation System and services, so that's really, it would be Pearson, but it's really NES, which moves to the online format, moves to more kind of national with some hint of Colorado as needed in alignment.
I really like the idea of aligning the content, the students' content, with what the teachers are doing, and the fact that there even is a pencil and paper test is shocking.
It's a good option.
I would like to have... Yeah. More of the, since the students have to take the technology-based tests, I would, and I'm sure these stakeholders are looking into the tests for the teachers being worded or whatever aligned with the way the students, so they are really understanding, A, what the students are being tested on, but B, hopefully, unless they have computer backgrounds, which I think they're going to have in order to do that incremental learning and outcome. Are the stakeholders talking about that?
They are. We actually are. Carol Gates from our teaching and learning unit is actually doing a crosswalk of what we expect our students to be able to do, and then with regard to how, when, why, and the content, as well as what these exams are. So we'll have that information, whether it's a 100% match, probably not, but it will be within an acceptable bandwidth of
and,
that. So we are.
And it's ongoing, and Absolutely. It has to be flexible. But thank you for that presentation. Thank you very much.
Dr. Flores.
So are these people that go into science, are they science majors? I mean, are they biology, chemistry, or is that what they major in?
It depends. Our educators come out. It depends on what program they entered. Some of them actually enter an educational program from the very beginning, and they end up with a general science background. Most of them enter into a very specific background, and then they do education on the backside of that. So a lot of them are coming out with a biology degree.
Yeah, they come out with a bachelor's in a very specific science area, and then the assessment they get goes back to subjects that they haven't looked at since freshman in high school, kind of thing.
Yes, Ms. Goff.
Thank you. Either of you, including Dr. Scheffel, have the course requirements changed at all? Is there a move toward more, at least some certain number of hours of experience with technology, for example? I mean, are all teachers coming out expected to have some tech teaching, not teaching it, but
skills
to be able to do anything these days?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the courses are aligned with the standards, so the question is, how do you divide it up? So you look at all the standards and map up all the course learning outcomes and the program learning outcomes and figure out which courses are going to have which content. Okay. So most universities have a course dedicated to technology. Some have more than one. Others lace it through the curriculum in more of a threaded way, but it has to be there, and it has to be there in redundancy.
Okay.
Not just once.
Well, you know, I don't remember the bill number, but the bill that passed that puts it upon us to include technology. I think it's in there, but unless it's written down, we can't say that for sure. But so we'll be adding that to the student standards as well. It's another thing to add on. Then there's the computer science component that. how far that goes into, if the intention right now is we're going to make sure it's in a high school courses, How does that filter in and permeate throughout? And just thought I'd check on that because.
And I do think you'll see us back here with a computer science endorsement. So you'll probably see, you see a lot of me anyway, but you'll see a lot of me come in the fall because there's several opportunities for us.
There isn't a computer science endorsement?
It's not in the way that it is listed in the new bill that has come forward. Okay. Not in such a deep way. It is more technology, and the programming aspect around that is not nearly as deep as I think most folks would like to see it, and that's been the feedback that we've received from the stakeholders just in the last couple of months, and especially as our computer science opportunities have arisen.
Any further questions? I have just one. This is likely to come back in June, or that's your preference. And when it comes back, there will be decision items on selection of vendor or vendors and what other decisions might be required of the board.
Absolutely. So at that point in time, what will come back is a recommendation for a vendor and then probably cut scores that are associated with that. And right now, lots of conversation around that. We can either do individual cut scores for the state of Colorado, or we can do national benchmark cut scores that are already established and then monitor for a year. So the committee is wrestling with that too, as to what that validity is. If we were to do Colorado specific cut scores, then that is another probably 6 to 7, 8 month process for us then to be able to implement them. If we went with a national benchmark cut score initially with research and articulation aligned for the next year, we could implement a lot quicker. But all of those will come forward from that stakeholder group, and it will be a presentation by one of the co-chairs with some support from me on the side, because this is completely stakeholder driven at this moment.
Okay, yes, Dr. Shep.
Out of town.
Yes.
Can you speak about that? You're saying that they're going to come back with a suggestion for one vendor. I mean, what's the vendor perspective on
that? We're really not sure yet. Right now, that's what they're wrestling with. So they are charged with ensuring that we have content assessments that meet the rigors associated with our expectations that the board has set forward, and then ensuring that we have valid, reliable assessments. And however that meets the needs. So they may come back and make a recommendation based off of these presentations that say, actually, we think we should accept all of them. Or they may come back and say, we think in multiple areas, similar to the way it is today, that we accept the place in one area and the praxis in one area, or the place and praxis in one area. So those are the things. They're wrestling with a lot of things in a very short period of time. But all of those recommendations will come back, and they'll be able to say, we're recommending one vendor because of this, or we're recommending two vendors, or we're not recommending any vendor right now because we want to do more research.
And I'd like this board to do the research on that, because there's two differences between Pearson, which is a for-profit company, and ETS, which is not, and so the way they price the test and the way they do item development. So, I mean, just saying, this group may come back with a recommendation, and I think sometimes we have a penchant to accept the recommendation and put in 100 hours on it, maybe, whatever. But, I mean, there's a lot of nuance underneath these tests. And, again, having options for people who have to take them, and they can't get their license unless they pass it, we need options. So I hope you'll guide their work that way.
I think there's two things. One, I would be happy to meet with any board member and dive a little bit more deeply into the response for information that helps us outline that, answer any questions in the next June meeting as well that might come up. I also am not really anticipating necessarily an adoption in June. It can go on the table for that, but it can also be extended to August so that we have more time. We have a month in there or so to be able to dig a little bit more deeply and or ask more questions about that recommendation. So we're prepared either way to be able to do that, and happy to meet individually with folks as well. If you have individual questions, or please send them forward to me so that I can help make sure and guide in the right way, because those are all incredibly valid concerns.
Yes, so Ms. Goff.
You know, apologies in advance if you mentioned this. Place. To what degree are we still using it? And has it been looked at, modified, revised, updated, and in what content areas? And I know that the stakeholders have the discretion and the right to be talking about that. I'm just curious. It's been, for year after year, we've talked about yes, we love PLACE because it's Colorado's test, but hasn't been able to keep up with what everything else that's gone on, including changes in teacher prep programs and direction forward, not to mention the student content standards. So
my very quick, easy answer to that is no. PLACE has not necessarily kept up with that. PLACE, we have not revamped those assessments in multiple years. This is that opportunity for us to do that. And again, we're not re-envisioning dumping a bunch of money into the revamp of a Colorado-specific. That is not one of the budget items we have on the plate today. If at the board's will they want to look at that, we'd be more than happy to and identify some funding streams for it. But it really has not been. And I think that's an important aspect to why we're pushing so quickly with the stakeholder group and why there's a sense of urgency in the field.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. O'Neill. You've given us something to look forward to. You know how we love setting cut scores.
You do. Yes. Thank you.
That's a joke. Okay,
you're
next.
Starting to relax. This is not good.
Probably. Let's see. Next item would be item 4.01, which is a carryover from yesterday on the bullying prevention education grant programs. And I think, let's see, hold
on. I'm pretty sure we have a motion.
We have,
we have a motion and a second.
We ran out of time. Right. So Dr. Goldsman and Dr. Ross are present, and so I don't know exactly where we left off. I hope you remember.
I do.
Perfect. You're on.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, members of the board. Would it be useful to quickly review what actions the board took yesterday and kind of,
I think so.
Okay.
Yes.
So we'll try to do this sequentially. Yesterday, in section 1.01, the definition of bullying, the board voted to replace deny with infringe, returning back to the original language in the statute. In section 3.03.3, the board voted to adopt the language which was in the handout that had some optional considerations. So that was 3.03.3 and a corresponding language in 5.01.3. In the same, in terms of the optional language that we provided the board, rule 3.03.4 was also adopted. And finally, to section 3.03.6.1, regarding the survey, this was not a written change that we had drafted in advance, but there were two changes there, that the language would adhere to what's in statute around the two elements that would be part of the required survey. So we will return to what is precisely in statute on that, and we'll add language related to a paper pencil option for students. I believe that covers all of the adopted changes that the board requested yesterday. Where we ended was, I believe that there were some questions from Dr. Scheffel regarding the requirement for a designation of a team of persons at each school. And I believe that this is section 3.03.5.3. I wanted to just make sure that perhaps it would be good to reiterate what the question is so that we can begin at that point. Dr. Scheffel, did I get the right section?
I think so. I think the idea is that this advisory team advises, not that they are not that the school is required to take their advice. Is there something like that? I mean, I think this, again, the language in the statute. They're an advisory committee, right?
Right.
And I think that's what that says, unless there's another place that language exists, does it?
So, 3.03 is... So in the authorizing statute, in section 22-93 2023-104-1B as part of the criteria that the Department of Education needs to use for reviewing the applications is that the grant recipients would be required to have a team of persons at each school who advise the school administration concerning the severity and frequency of bullying. So it is a requirement of the grant program to have that. So this language does reflect that.
That's fine.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Yes, so Ms. Masnick?
Just before I forget.
Yes.
We noticed a little mistake here on one of the option or the optional change for 5.01.3.
Yes.
You have facility schools twice.
We will fix that. Thank you for noticing.
I just really enjoy being able to correct you.
Well, and we always appreciate the better eye on these. So thank
I could
you.
Do a red pen thing on it.
That would make me feel more comfortable, actually.
Make you feel right at home.
Right at home.
Okay. Any other issues or questions? Yes, Dr. Shepard?
And then it's opt-in, and then is that language somewhere?
Currently, that language, the specifics of the opt-in procedures are not in there. And this may be a question for Tony, but the there is a typical procedure that's used for any surveys of students where parents need to opt in. We can go back and see where else in statute that language exists.
I'm just thinking if it says voluntary, but that's not a very clear word.
That language
should say opt in.
That language tracks the language of the statute. Procedures to ensure the confidentiality of students' answers to the survey and clarify that the completion of the survey shall be voluntary and shall not be required by any student. So I think that would be.
In other words, voluntary could be opt-in or opt-out.
That's correct. I think it would be within your rulemaking authority to indicate in some manner that should be an opt-in.
That's what I'm thinking. So I guess I don't know where that goes, but when you say it's voluntary, it should say opt-in.
So, Dr. Shuffle, that language is in 3.03.6. It's towards the end of that particular paragraph. It says the survey shall be voluntary and shall not be required of the student. Would you think an option would be that students shall voluntarily opt in?
Yes.
Would that be a...
Or do the parents opt in or the students opt in? Or I don't know how that works.
I think
typically
that's...
Typically both.
Yeah.
Typically both.
So would it be that both parents and students would voluntarily opt in? Is that
that's the intention, isn't it? It's an opt-in. That's what I understood it to be. So I think if that's the case, it should be stated in the
motion.
I'm sorry, Ms.
Masnick? Along those lines, I was just wondering if that's something we should consider as standard language for all programs like this. You know, we've talked about that with the Healthy Kids Survey, and you know, certain sensitive subjects. Perhaps we have a standard opt-in language. Would that be appropriate?
In terms of putting in the rules?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that would. One thing to keep in mind here is what you're asking the districts to do in terms of their applications to show how they're going to demonstrate this.
Right.
So I think, you know, in a case like this, you'd say, you know, whatever you're showing us, it has to show an opt-in with both parents and students being consulted.
It should be an active opt-in, you know, not just passive, voluntary, whatever, because the whole deal with surveys, right, there's a power differential between the people giving the survey and the people taking the survey. If it's opt-in, it should be an active opt-in. There should be procedures for that. The parents know about, students know about. That's the way research works. You're gathering data.
Ms. Rankin?
So I'd like to have that clarified as to how we're going to do that. I mean, is that before the whole bullying prevention program is accepted? Will every student have a paper that goes home that explains the program and then the parent signs it and opts in? I mean, is that how that would work?
Not on the front end, no, because what you're looking here again is criteria for somebody applying for the grant. If they receive the grant, I think what you'd want to see is a procedure. Presumably, it would be something like what the Healthy Kids Colorado survey, where a letter would be sent home, or you know, something would be asked to be returned, saying yes, my kid can take this.
Would that be optional for each district, or would that be part of the program?
Part of the grant should be part of the grant.
Oh, I think what you're contemplating doing here is making some type of procedure like that a condition of receiving
the grant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. It's part of the
The districts who choose to participate in the grant have a list of programs to choose from, right? That's the whole idea. So in your awareness of this list, do all of them require some sort of surveying? If there's a survey involved of kids on all of these lists of available programs to use, if there's a survey involved, that's one thing. This is probably one of the least critical points of the rule making that we have to think about, but maybe not. But I'm thinking that if we don't put it in the right place, the opt-in, if we don't put it in the right place, it could be a little confusing as to whether or not it's assumed that every single one of these programs is going to require a survey. If they don't, then this is sort of, it's a moot point in a way.
Yeah, as of right now, what is required are the two questions that were adopted yesterday. So every student... every student in the grant program will be opt in to answering questions about those two items.
Right.
So regardless of the program they select, at least those very two will require an opt in. As far as I understand so far is what we're discussing.
Right.
For those two questions will require an opt in. Now if there's a program that includes other surveys,
then it also has to be opt-in, right?
That would be...
Well, they basically already opt-in to the bullying program, right?
No, in other words, the survey is two questions as required by statute. Then the program they choose, you're saying, may have additional surveys. And I would like... The parents need to... I mean, if you look at... What is it? What's the website? Familypolicy.ed.gov, PPRA. I mean, those are so clear that saying that parents need notification. You can't just... By virtue of the fact the school gets the grant and the kids opt in to answering two questions, now they're subject to all kinds of surveys with whatever program they adopt. I mean, that's not transparent to parents or kids. So I think they need to opt in.
I think probably part of the way to resolve this is, I suspect when these grant applications come back and you select some for awards, I wouldn't put it on the consent agenda. I would probably circulate those applications to the members for them to read, because I think we're going to be very curious about how well those comply with the intent of the board, and at least I, for one, will take the time to read the grant applications.
I'd
so,
like to see the RFP and see how
yeah,
it really works.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see the RFP and we'll see how much it matches, and I think this is a difficult enough issue. It's not that we don't trust you, but I think we really want to see what's out there and what's being proposed. Yes, Ms. Mazur?
Yeah, but along those lines, I mean, as far as the rulemaking process goes, I'm wondering if you have the opt-in for the survey, the two-question survey, but the opt-in also includes opting in to whatever surveys may be included in the bullying program the school chooses.
Right.
So it seems like for rulemaking purposes, if we want to make sure that that is happening, we need to make sure that that's part of the rules, not only for the two questions required by the grant program, but for any surveys also included within a program a district will choose.
If I may, yeah. Perhaps if you change the language in 3.3.6 to indicate, you know, ensure the description of the procedures, blah, 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 for, you know, any survey given pursuant to this program, to indicate that it's, And I think that's going to be the case. I think what you're going to do is select a program, get a canned survey that will include these areas that are required. But I think that would just clarify that, you know, the opt-in is to any survey that's done under this program.
Yes.
Given that language, does that provide the opportunity then for the staff to add the two questions that are a part of this to whatever survey the kids are going to get anyway, so we don't have double surveying?
Well, that might be a more practical question about how these work in terms of these programs.
Does that allow for that?
I think it would.
Okay.
I think it would. It would clarify that whatever surveys you're giving, there has to be an opt-in.
Right. And then that way, they can just add that onto a survey so kids are not answering questions twice. That might be, as you said, practical.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me that the idea is that parents and students shall voluntarily opt into any surveys used as part of this school's grant program. That's kind of what the board is discussing right now. Did I summarize that accurately?
That's what about the bullies?
Would it be good to say the district, if they receive the grant, or the school, will develop active opt-in procedures for students to take the survey, right?
Take any survey.
Any survey.
Attached to the grant program.
Attached to this grant.
I think that makes sense. Any objection to that in your delineation? Okay. All right, any other questions?
I think I need to make a different motion.
Well, before we do that, could you run through the due process requirements? I couldn't find them, which doesn't mean they're not there, it just means I couldn't find them. Where are they in this particular version of the rules?
So, Mr. Chairman, it's in be on page 3, and it's section 3.03.5.4. And that is that each school, as part of their bullying education and prevention policy, would include provisions for adequate due processes and safeguards for students accused of engaging in bullying behaviors.
When we review the applications, we'll see how robust that their attempt to meet that requirement is.
That's okay. Correct.
Perfect. Anything else from members of the board? Yes, Dr. Sheffield?
I just have one more question. Could you just check this research out, because I tried to and I couldn't find it. Can I just read this language to you from stopbullying.ed.gov? Several states have anti-bullying laws allowing their departments of education to offer funding to public schools to train their staff in detecting and preventing bullying. Colorado created the Colorado Trust to support youth programs about bullying and violence prevention. Several other states use public-private partnerships to fund their initiatives. Contact your state Department of Education, health, and so forth. So, I mean, it seems like there's some initiative that links this stuff, but I can't seem to find if this is like a sort of a leveraged initiative across entities, public-private partnerships, one of which is this grant. I just like to get a sense of the universe of what's going on in Colorado, because I don't know.
So, Dr. Sheffield, we can absolutely look into what the Colorado
website.
Trust is doing around that. Scott's office, right? Scott's office would be the office that would be leading any of the work on bullying prevention, so that he's not aware of that. I think is perhaps they might be doing an independent program. And I just don't even know how current that information is, because you know how sometimes there can be programs that exist for a few years, and by the time a report comes out, it's defunct. But we will absolutely look into that and get back to you.
Thank you.
Sorry. Any other questions? Let me just make one comment before we vote. As I understand it, the statute that the enabling legislation for this passed in 2010, is that correct? 2011. So this is not unusual with the legislature. They pass something, takes them 5 years to fund it. That was in a response, as I remember, the statute passing was in response to particular specific incidents. So schools have been working on this problem for 5 years, and in my conversations with Dr. Ross and with you, it would appear that a lot of districts have programs in place that seem to be pretty effective. that they've done that somehow miraculously on their own without grants, and that substantial progress, based on some of the reading I've done, appears to have been made in this area. And I would like to be in a position to say that, you know, at least in this instance, this government program will not become a monument to eternal life, and that we have $2 million this year in grants. We have $1 million next year. The legislature, I think, cut that in half with their budget constraints. That absent, I think one of the things I'd like to see your office do is that, you know, to have a recommendation for the legislature when they go into their budget cycle in August, no, actually be in this year will be in November, December, that we have a recommendation as to whether or not this program ought to be continued based on how many districts have done things on their own, based on number of applicants for the grant and things like that, so that if we reach the conclusion that government has done what it can to solve this problem, that additional grants may not be required, and that there might be better use for this particular million or $2 million. So, and I think that in trying last night to think why I was so troubled by this program, it's simply now 5 years out of date. The legislation is 5 years old. Lots has happened. The legislation really didn't contemplate what happened over the last 5 years. And I think we have an obligation to determine if this is still a legitimate need vis-a-vis all the other needs in public education. So, yes, Dr. Shuffle?
Yeah, I just like to echo that in the sense that this is the kind of work that every school ought to be doing in terms of civility, respect, respecting each other, you know, and just, I mean, if any school isn't doing that, I don't know what they are doing, you know. So I would hope that we wouldn't need grants to incentivize schools to put programs in place that have basic human civility and respect built into how we interface with each other in school all day. I hope everybody's doing that. I would feel sad to think we need grants to incentivize.
Should we do this? But because we have new technology.
Yeah.
And new That's means correct. Of communicating, and that the kids have taken on to, you know, onto these areas, then, you know, you have bullying, a different kind of bullying taking place, and we are aware that some districts, you know, don't know what to do with it, and so. It's bullying is going to take place in different kinds of medium, and right now I think it's really taking hold on Facebook and all these other computer outlets, and I think that's what's different and probably more deadly because it's in private. And I think it's just a different kind of bullying that's around.
Did you have a comment, Ms. Goff?
Sure. Am I right or not? The funding for this specifically has been cut for the next fiscal year. Isn't that true? It's been cut by half anyway?
That's correct, because we received $2 million in January. I believe what the legislature was doing was kind of looking ahead and understanding that we would unlikely be able to promulgate rules and get grants out during this fiscal year. We are able to carry this over, so I think they anticipated that and saw this as an opportunity to look at next year's funding.
That might give us all a chance to do a little forecasting, and if this specific type of program is really not, say the word because it's the wrong word, if it's not most efficient, most productive to think of using this money for specifically for bullying, anti-bullying programs, maybe we can talk about getting it integrated into some of the other more all-encompassing culture building or character ed or something else. I don't know. I suppose I would take legislation.
I think we talked about that when I spoke with them about that.
Because that might end up being, when we talk about it, we'll know, but it might end up being our non-academic indicator for accountability, whether it's in our state plan or if we look more toward the ESSA level on that. But I'd hate to see the whole idea be set over here, forgotten. But I think, you know, we can be creative about this, but also more efficient, because I agree, there are incredible things happening all over the place, and there is not the capacity right now to do some incredible things in some places. So we don't want to forget the whole thing. We just want to be smart about it.
Okay. Dr. Schroeder, would you like to withdraw your earlier motion and make a second motion?
Yep. So I'd like to withdraw my earlier motion and replace it with motion to approve the rules for the School Bullying Prevention and Education Grant Program as amended.
Okay, that's a proper motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Ms. Masnick and Dr. Flores. Is there further discussion? Would you care to call roll, please, Ms. Bursa?
Board Member Flores.
Aye.
Board Member Goth.
Aye.
Board Member Masnick.
Aye.
Board Member Rankin.
Aye.
Board Member Scheffel.
Yes.
Board Member Schroeder.
Yes.
And Chairman Durham.
Yes. That motion is adopted by a vote of 7-0. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And let's see, we are now at, where are we here?
And thank you for your patience.
5.0. Let's see. We're ahead of schedule for that, so could we, is it possible we could deal with the, where do I see it right now? The update on the listening tour. Any chance we could pull that out of order?
Yes.
Oh,
absolutely.
Perfect. Let's do that. I can find my listening tour notes. Probably not. Here it is. Okay. All right, so. Excellent. Okay.
Today is the Alyssa Pearson show.
Sorry, you're going to be so sick of me.
Brought to you by Alyssa Pearson.
Thank you. It will be interrupted with commercial messages.
Pictures of her kids.
Yeah.
Think of something to entertain you with.
Every once in a while, I'll pop in just so you can hear a different voice.
Perfect. We got messages. Some recognitions. In
all
there.
Right, Ms. Pearson.
Okay, hold on. I'm just getting the PowerPoint up. It's okay.
You did a PowerPoint? I thought you were.
Oh, that's for later. That's the next week. Remember, it's the show today.
It's a show. Okay.
We've got PowerPoint.
Sorry.
Whiteboards. We've got recognition. It's all fun.
Okay. Oh, we're waiting. I'm sorry.
Okay. It's coming.
Thinking.
And first, I apologize that you all got this just a few days ago. We were gathering from last week. The listening tours were Wednesday last week. We're traveling back, and we're gathering the information from both sites and trying to condense that and pull it together for you. So it just took us a few days to get that. But we wanted to make sure you got most recent information from what we were heard being out on the road. So these are the scheduled, as of this moment, ESSA listening tour events. Last Wednesday we did two. There was one in Pueblo and one in Grand Junction. I was in Grand Junction. Pat Chapman and another team were in Pueblo. Pat is not here today because the third listening tour is today in Durango. So he is down there with a team of people. So we traded, and we're trading off back and forth. We have Greeley on Monday. The commissioner will be there, and I'll be there, and a bunch of other staff. We have Buena Vista on Wednesday. We have Thornton the following Monday. We have one in Lyman on the Friday, the 20th. We have a webinar scheduled on June 1st, and then we're in the process of scheduling some additional ones in Boulder or Loveland and in the Denver area. And in addition, we have a lot of requests that have come in from different groups that meet regularly, different stakeholder groups that have asked for staff to come out and talk about ESSA. So we've been getting those scheduled on as well.
Thank you.
So And if you all have other events, please let us know. So we're going to play a little game. Which of these didn't happen at the first listening tour event?
I'm going to guess they all happened.
I know which one's
Grandjunction, number one.
More than 100 people learned about ESSA and provided feedback.
Is that in Grandjunction?
Grandjunction.
Total. Okay. 16 CDE staff members were on site to present, answer questions, work the video camera, register staff, and handle media. The power went out for 5 minutes. 2 television interviews were conducted. 1 national newspaper was in attendance. Before the evening session in Grand Junction, the library went on shelter in place. Due to a person of interest in the area, attendees couldn't get into the library for the second session. After waiting 30 minutes to see if shelter in place was lifted, the event was moved down the street to the district offices. No comments were shared about assessment. And parents, charter schools, higher education, district staff, teachers, early childhood educators, English learner directors, advocates for students with disabilities, and retired educators were in attendance. So, anybody have any guesses what didn't happen?
I'm hoping it's the 5 minute power out.
You're hoping it's that?
Yeah.
No comments were shared about assessment.
You guys got it. So, power did not actually go out. Power stayed on the whole time.
Yes, right.
And we got lots of comments about it.
Yeah, lots of comments.
But everything else happened, including that whole shelter in place. In my 13 years at CDE, I've never had that in a training happen before.
Well, which one of you was the person of interest?
Well, there were a few CDE staff outside the building at the time it happened. It could have been any one of them.
So no comments were made about assessment?
No, that didn't happen.
Oh, that didn't happen.
Two things, though.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No, we got lots of comments.
Two truths and a lie.
Yeah. Yes.
Nobody cares a bit.
The shelter in place was interesting. We could get out of the library, but they wouldn't let us back in, and we had people on the other side. So for a while, we were passing notes back and forth, and then the police security outside the door wouldn't let us do that anymore. So then eventually at 6, we just said, okay, we're just going to go out, and we got out there, and there was somebody from the district office, from District 51, and said, hey, I can let you in down the street. So we moved down the road to their district offices and set up there.
So they thought you guys were ICE's people?
It was what they thought was going on.
So, I was told that the afternoon meeting in Grand Junction was limited to education staff, and that it was not open to the public. That was the perception that was.
That was the perception. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll work on the messaging on that because I don't think there was anything in messaging for that.
You know, no matter how much you communicate, this is why there were people there at night who actually would have preferred to be there in the daytime.
Oh, interesting. Okay. We will work on getting that messaging clear for going forward.
I'm wondering if somebody on the other side may have told people that. Oh, just educate. I mean,
What I'm going to guess is what was said is that the afternoon session is for staff, mm-hmm. education staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the evening session is for the public.
Yep. We had...
I wonder if someone took that liberty.
We had a retired educator there during the afternoon who was just like a community member who used to be in education. We had a parent there in the afternoon who was really vocal and really insightful on some things. The PEAK advocacy group for students with disabilities was there in the afternoon. So we had some non-district staff there, but there were a lot of district staff and they were there. But in the evening session, it was half and half. We only had 5 people that ended up staying and coming down the road with us. But yeah, so, but we'll work on that messaging for sure. So here's a little bit more of a breakdown. We had 77 people total in Pueblo, and then we had 36 total in Grand Junction. We had really, I can't speak as well to Pueblo. Dana was down at Pueblo, so she can chime in if she wants to. But Grand Junction people were really focused. They were really interested in the conversation. There was a lot of identifying of problems, but then a lot of solution-oriented. Well, could we do this and could we do that? That came out of the conversation. Right now, we have more than 450 participants registered for all of them. Those are just the listening tour events. Those aren't the other meetings that we're going to that people have asked us to come to. So we're getting to a lot of people, I think. Dana and Jeremy and the communications team has done a tremendous amount of work on community outreach and prep and support at the listening tours, too. They've had advertisements in the local newspapers. There's been news releases in each community, opinion articles co-authored by the commissioner and the local superintendent to let people know about the event. working with district staff, Facebook and Twitter posts. Lynn Bamberry, who works in Pat Chapman's office, has been she and her team have been making phone calls to local organizations to let people know that it's happening, invite them. We have template letters for you all to send out to any constituents that you want. And we've been reaching out to the legislators in the area as well. I know it was probably hard last week for people still in session. And just our regular communication channels. So we've really been trying to get the word out.
Yes, Ms. Madden.
You mentioned other meetings you're going to, like groups that have asked you, like who's been asking you to?
So like this morning, Brad is at the Early Childhood Council because they asked him to come and talk about how ESSA interacts with early childhood and what's mentioned. So, Colleen, do you know, Dana? I'm trying to think of all the other groups that have called.
Yeah, we've also had a lot of our BOCES regional meetings ask us to come and take out, you know, a few hours out of their meeting agenda. We've also had all the superintendent council meetings that we've scheduled on there. And then a lot, you know, that we're working with the advocacy groups to, you know, join their meetings when possible. So we have over, I think it's over 20 additional meetings that we're going to per invitation.
And if you all have a group of people, you know, people would like somebody from CD to come talk about ESSA and start getting outreach, we'd be happy to do that. Just let us know.
I would just like to get a list of all the groups.
Sure.
They're talking to.
Absolutely.
That'd be good.
Well, and some of the stuff isn't scheduled. Is it? Some stuff is not yet scheduled.
Whenever it's scheduled.
Yeah, we'll keep a comprehensive list because part of what the U.S. Department asked for in the state plan is how you've consulted with stakeholders. So we'll make sure we have that all documented every meeting and group we've pulled together to include in the plan. So we can share that with you, and we'll just keep a running list of that.
Oh.
Ms. Rankin, do you have a...
Yeah, I have a question. Can you register on your homepage for one of the online sessions? Because I know that the first one is June 1st, and I just, if I put it out there that they can find it on your homepage, if it's easy for them to find, then they can get the information.
Can we get it up on that homepage?
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Goff?
Business, but in the sense of all categories, chambers of commerce or... associations.
Yeah, I think Lynn has been making those phone calls to people to invite them. They've been calling Rotary clubs and just trying to get every community organizations to know about the event.
The others, I've been thinking about a lot of them, but popping to mind was also the media, press. Has there been any requests?
Yeah, there's been some great letters.
Some educational
joint letters,
overviews, or whatever.
Yeah.
So
Dana, do you want to talk about?
They could help us.
Yes, please.
I think that there's been a pretty good coverage of the listening tours themselves in the local press. They really have been quite interested. They've sent reporters from their local papers and TV. We've done TV interviews both in Grand Junction and Pueblo. So they have, you know, they have tried to cover the events themselves. In terms of, like, really digging in and covering, I don't think the local press, like in Pueblo and Grand Junction, have been able to do that. But they have covered the fact that we've been there and we've talked to folks, and they interviewed superintendents from the area and other folks who were in attendance at the meetings. So I think there has been a lot of exposure in the media of this tour.
I saw one summary. I don't think it was the Pueblo Chieftain, but is there another paper?
Well, at least.
But I read an article, some coverage of it. It was pretty good, but what I was looking for, and frankly, I do not remember if it was included at the bottom, but there were something I read recently had the links to the ESSA blog page and something else we have that's nice to have on there. I felt good seeing three distinct, totally relevant links back to our pages, and I appreciated that. So any outlet who's able to do that would be great.
Mm-hmm. So. And if you can get it out so that I can put it on my Facebook, know, that has...
Deb?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I was wondering, were there other, just looking at the PowerPoint and the themes and the questions and so forth, were there other handouts that accompanied this then, or not? Was this really what people got?
Yeah. So we had emailed you all the draft PowerPoint of the listening tour, and I can't remember if we sent the updated version, but we're cleaning it up based on that first tour, so we'll get it to you. There was about 30 slides that we went into in terms of the content that we were doing with them, so you all, it's in the draft. We'll get you the revised one now so you can
Thank
see
you.
The detailed
Thank
content.
So here's my question. Yeah. Can I just read a quick quote? Are we okay on time?
I think we're fine.
Here's a quote. I don't think a parent is going to notice any difference when they take their child to school next year that the school is somehow operating under a new federal law, said so-and-so, a policy advisor for education. The only thing they're likely to notice is that their state or district may spend time reducing the number of tests they have been layering on over the past few years, a problem that, contrary to belief, wasn't really a federal one to begin with. Question, as you're having these tours, is that a focus of the conversation? And I see one of the themes here, but then I see another question that is, in addition to holding a license, should teachers be required to demonstrate competency in a subject area? Where did that come from? Teachers do demonstrate competency in the 800 hours they have to spend in schools, and they have master teachers observing them, looking at their competency, filling out all kinds of paperwork, because that's what the universities require. So, I mean, I'd like to know that these listening tours are really about taking advantage of whatever little flexibility exists in ESSA, and isn't also an opportunity to say, and what else can we require, you know, but help me understand.
Sure. If you don't mind, we'll just work through the themes and get into it right now. Is that okay?
Great.
Okay.
But while we're just on this part, I have a question.
Sure.
And that is, have you identified a radius or a distance area that you want to capture when you pick a location? I mean, as we were looking in CD2, the discussion that I had with some school board members is, where's the best place to have this in order to capture 4 or 5 school districts?
Yeah.
But the reality is, in CD2, I have 14.
Yes.
And so I'm trying to figure out, as you sort of map the opportunities for attendance, have you looked at what radius you're capturing?
I know what you're talking about. We can do that, and I think the other thing we can do when we look at best location for you is to look at the registration for Thornton for the Adams 12 event and to see which district staff and which community members are coming from there to figure out, like, if we're getting a lot of Boulder people from there, then we could figure out maybe going further north.
Right, and we're not seeing, actually, the Boulder board member did not suggest Boulder.
Okay.
So in order to capture St. Vrain and Loveland and Estes.
Okay. Where should we be?
That's where the Loveland. So there's never, I don't think there's been a discussion about having it in Boulder at all. And you're right, they could either go to the one in Loveland or they could go to the one in Thornton.
Okay.
Thornton's actually pretty close for Boulder.
Yeah, but absolutely.
If you have a criteria that you've set for a certain radius, that helps.
I don't think we have a set criteria, but I think we know kind of generally where people end up going to and showing up from, just all the different training staff do at CDE, so we can look through that, get some feedback on where do we know that people usually feel comfortable going to.
Thank you. Go ahead and finish
Please proceed. Oh, Jane, I'm
Thank
sorry.
Thank you very much.
Sorry.
It's okay. Same goes for Jefferson County. It's a distance of somewhat between Thornton and Morrison.
Yeah.
But more importantly, the population and what loops in to that part of Jeffco. You could cover some Denver, could cover some Littleton, Englewood, Sheridan, that sort of southern horseshoe down there. Not to mention that the mountain area, the foothills of Jeffco. So we have
that's another part of my district, all the way to Park.
Area.
It's outside of Jeffco. Park County.
Just put in the hopper. Let's not forget that part of Jefferson County.
And if you would like to
cover a lot of ground, and it's a sizable distance from Loveland or Boulder or Thornton.
But then you could capture Clear Creek.
It can do a lot of
that. That's why I think some thinking
maybe
about
we should do some
the rate.
You laugh. And it can be later in the, it can be spread out.
This is really quite amusing. Yes. Talking your back. We got one in Lyman, right? For my district?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes, well, Lyman got added.
Dove Creek. Let's see.
But you guys tell us if you want requests for other locations, we will work on getting them scheduled. So
at Conoco Station at the intersection that we were
asking.
Yes, sir. And Mr. Chair, could I?
Yes,
and
please.
CD1.
Commissioner Crandall wanted to comment.
And I was waiting for Board Member Shuffle to get back in the room because she just opened the door. It's funny because my Thursday thought is what Board Member Shuffle just brought out. We were at a district not too long ago, and everyone, all the leadership's in the room talking about assessment and performance framework and accountability, and the same district has 1/4 of the students who live in their district boundaries leave every day to go to neighboring districts. And a bunch of the adults in the room are arguing a little, not arguing, that's too strong a word, but talking about growth versus measurement versus assessment versus accountability, what framework labels, everything. And you realized, I finally said, hey, time out, can we change the conversation? You have over 750 kids who wake up every morning and say, nah, I'm not going to come to school here. I'm going somewhere else. When's the last time we asked those kids what they want at their school? Because the quote you just read is so accurate. And I don't blame anybody in this room. I blame the NCLB said, this is how we're going to operate. And somewhere we forgot the conversation about kids and actually engaging kids. And so the title of my Thursday thought is, the water's not getting to the end of the row. And it was interesting as I leaned over the superintendent and said, does an individual student have a vision of what he or she personally can accomplish at your district? And I promise you, they don't care about your label. And this is the student, not the parent. They don't care about your label, your performance framework, your assessment, your accountability. They don't care about your teacher evaluation system. They don't care. Doesn't mean we shouldn't. But they don't, and they truly are the customer at the end. And so under ESSA, I would hope that we can kind of right the ship just a little bit and focus back on the student and what they need. And there's some great stuff happening in Colorado around this area, and it's fun to see it in place. We have big teams today up in St. Vrain seeing what computer science is being done today so that we can help duplicate that across the state. Anyway, soapbox is over. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the second.
Good. Please proceed.
So here are some of the general themes. Again, we've just been in two locations so far. There's another one going on today. But generally what we heard was a lot about local control for determining use of funds and the desire for that, appreciation for wider options for use of federal funds, because that's a lot of what's in ESSA is now that the allowable uses for different programs have expanded. So there's a lot more options, and a lot of those options are really focused on whole child. So that there's just kind of a broader opportunity. On the flip side, it's not like right now it doesn't look like we're going to get more money under those programs. So there's more options for how to spend it, but it's not like we've got more money to use for all those different things. But people appreciated that there's wider options and more flexibility for the use of the funds. And then we had some really good conversations around the interplay between state and federal policy, because it's really, and one of our first slides in the PowerPoint tries to illustrate, you've got a school in the center and district policy are kind of at the core, but then you've got state and federal policy going on around the outside, and sometimes state policy is more prescriptive and sometimes federal policy is more prescriptive. Sometimes now we have more flexibility with federal policy, but we still have criteria in our state laws that don't have that same flexibility that are in federal. So it's not an easy, clear-cut conversation. I think it's really important for people to understand that there's these two things that are really playing back and forth in some of it, and especially around assessment and teacher qualification. That's where we spend a lot of time talking, because those are concerns people have, and there's this real, not complicated, but there's an interplay between state and federal law there. So to get into more of those details, in terms of assessment, some of the questions we were asking were, how should we measure student progress toward meeting the standards? There's, options in ESSA that some of them were also in No Child Left Behind. In some ways it's more like financially efficient to do assessments the way we do, right? They're one time a year, they're scored like that. It's more straightforward, but NCLB and ESSA allow for multiple measures over different times of the year with more deeper kind of questions and performance tasks. That's allowed in there. We just have to think about the financial implication of that and the time implication of that. But we had some really good conversations with people about what those assessments should or could look like, and then about how the state should consider the 95% participation requirement, because that's left to states to determine what that is. In most cases, it's left to the state. And probably the best quote that I heard from during the session was, if we get the first bullet right, meaning how to measure student progress, then we shouldn't have to worry about the second one. But the second shouldn't be a problem. People will want to participate. So I think that was like summed it up very concisely and was a good theme for thinking going forward, how we handle things. It was very clear that assessment should provide timely, useful information. People want that data back quickly so they can use it for instruction, at least a part of it. And districts are really feeling caught between state and federal participation policies. Just put it out there. They're not sure where to go. They'll feel like they're walking this tightrope about parents who want to excuse their kids, but worrying about what the federal implications are, and you know, tried to clarify where we're at right now with federal implications, but it's a hard thing, and they're struggling with that some. So we definitely heard that there.
May I ask a question?
Dr. Flores.
Is that possible? When we get these monies, and we, of course, want to give the monies to the best teachers, you know, in under No Child Left Behind, monies were given to schools who had, you know, the best teachers, but that didn't necessarily mean that those teachers were teaching the kids that needed really the best, that needed the money, because sometimes these hard-to-serve schools got some money, but they didn't get, well, the way...
I'm trying to figure out what you're... I don't know what
there was program. There was a bill that... was passed. I think it was Mr. Johnston, Senator Johnston, passed that bill about giving teachers, you know, rewarding teachers for doing their good work. And in Denver, I don't know, maybe some districts allotted the money differently, but in Denver, the money was allotted to teachers whose schools did really well. Okay, and so...
You need to help tell me what bill, because this is the first I've ever heard
okay.
of this.
Okay, think about the idea. Don't think about the bill.
Well, but,
I don't know
but it's
I can
not
come
real.
Up with a bill.
I think we're a little off topic here.
Well, no, I'm talking about monies here. And the people out there that I've heard from Denver are very concerned that the money is spent on schools that are where you have a large number of kids who are poor, kids who are second language speakers, kids who are black, who don't, you know, who are usually lumped together in that pool of poor kids. And they want the money to be spent with those kids so that they can do better. So, and according to the feds want it to be spent in that way. And we don't want to spend the money in schools where kids are doing at the 99th percentile. They don't have free and reduced lunch, so
okay, let somebody tell me what bill you're describing because this is.
I think it sounds like the Denver has its own merit pay system.
Merit pay.
There we go.
System.
That's
and
right.
The district
doesn't seem
and
fair.
That, and that's district.
That's a district that's decision. A, okay, that, I feel.
Yeah, that's not
yeah,
state.
It's not
that's not state. That's not federal.
There is a.
It's terrible.
That's not a state law or a federal law.
But it here we have a large number of kids that are poor. They're not getting, you know, the monies that.
So the majority of the ESEA programs, at least the dollars that come to the state, because the U.S. Department of Ed does have some grants that they allocate directly to districts, but for the state programs, it's really around Title I, Title II, and Title III in the past. There's a Title IV now. Those are formula dollars that go to districts. Title I is allocated based on poverty rates from the census data to districts, so it really goes to the districts based on their concentration and amount of students in poverty. Title II is moving towards being based on poverty, but it was more based on population previously. And Title III is for English language learners and based on that population. So there weren't, and those are all formula dollars to support students, support teacher professional development, but there was no reward system in those. So, you know, and this is where all that state and federal gets confusing. So in terms of school improvement, this is another area we spent some time having.
Just move on.
Yeah, so sure.
Could you just give me a little bit of additional information on the 95% assessment? We have a policy on that, so what's the issue?
I think districts are concerned because they've spent so much time under No Child Left Behind, and they've seen some of the letters the U.S. Department of Education has put out about what could happen if you don't meet your 95%. So we've said, you know, this is how we're handling it as a state and what the U.S. Department of Ed has said to us, but they've got a lot of concerns of, okay, we get that, you know, this is where you're at and what the board has said, but we're still really worried, especially with how much they rely on some of those federal dollars, that their federal dollars could be taken at some point if they're not meeting participation requirements. So they're just feeling like a little confused. Not confused. A little like they're walking this fine line trying to figure out their role between state and federal policy.
Well, those monies flow to the state, correct?
Money flows to the state. The state can retain a little bit for administration, and the rest flows out to the districts through the SEA,
so
through CDE.
How can they possibly feel threatened because our policy is not penalized?
People are worried about money, right? They always worry about money. So, yes, our policy's been clear, and we put that out there, but I think the letter, that January letter, I think it was, that the U.S. Department sent out, not the one specific to Colorado. After they sent a specific Colorado letter, they sent a general one to everybody that was like, these are all the things that we could do, and that scared people. We didn't distribute that, I don't believe, that we put that out anywhere, but people see those things, and if they were worried that their money is at risk, they're going to be concerned.
But didn't we ask for a clear, succinct one-pager? I don't think I got it. Did I get it? I mean, we asked the department to do one, and you were working on it.
About the participation? Yeah, we sent that out
2 weeks ago.
I'm trying to remember.
We can to the districts.
But we also sent it to the board.
In the last couple of weeks?
Yes, it was after that last board meeting. We can go back and resend it, sure.
And do you think it would be good to take that letter to those meetings? Because I think there is so much confusion around this issue.
So I think
people are afraid that it's because they don't understand how the money flows.
I think we need to
be extremely clear.
I just wonder if the fear isn't manufactured deliberately.
It could be.
That's about what I'm concluding. Either that or we got people in positions of authority. I have a hard time reading English.
I hear of cases where people feel threatened in the district. They feel the district's threatening them because they'll be somehow disadvantaged if they don't opt their kids in. And I just think... Yeah. I need to revisit that document, but if it's really crystal clear, that ought to be handed out. Let's put that out.
Well, I ran into a raft of that occupied I don't know how much of my time, and I'm really tired of it.
I still get it.
I come from a community where there's a high level of opt-out, and from a community perspective, there's huge pushback. So the taxpayers are saying, you know, we really do believe in some sort of assessment. If you've got the wrong assessment,
fix it.
Right. But don't opt out. And so every community is different.
Right. And Denver sends out letters that are intimidating to parents.
Every district is different, but I don't think the issue is just letting people know that they can opt out. I think we've got about 20 to 25% of our voting public that are parents and have kids in school. And then we have a lot of taxpayers who just pay their taxes and they're saying, wait a minute, this kid can't take a test. One test? It's that bad? I'm suggesting that the discussion is broader just than telling everybody it's okay to opt out, because it's not okay for some of our taxpayers who are saying, you know, we want to know what's happening. We want to know that kids are learning. We want to know that our tax dollars are getting there.
I sure don't mean to be difficult about this issue, but I think it's really pretty simple. If you get any of those people who think somehow they have the right to manage other children, let me talk to them. Just give them my phone numbers. I'd be more than happy to disabuse them of the knowledge that they're not their children.
That's not the point. The point is the district's going to come to them to ask for some more money, and they're not going to provide it in the tax measures. This is a broader issue than just my kid.
But the children cannot be compelled to take tests.
Because totally agree. That's not the point. That's not the point. You're kind of missing the point.
No, I understand the point, but the bottom line is the answer is always that it is up to the parents of those children to decide, and nobody should be trying to pressure those parents of children to have those. So I don't know.
And
I
your
think you're right that every district is dealing with this in a different way. I know that Douglas County does, I think, a pretty good job of explaining to parents, yes, you can opt out if you so choose. You can do that. But they also explain to them that there is the 95% consideration, et cetera, et cetera. So that it's an informed
and Angelica,
they get about it. So,
Angelica,
and
you have
some districts are frankly making parents feel a little
threatened.
So,
well, not in Boulder, believe me.
We can lead them to water, but we can't make them drink.
Okay. So.
Dr. Flores and then Ms. Groff.
And Angelica, you have one of the districts, Boulder, who has the most opt-out.
That's my point. It's creating a real dilemma in our community. A real dilemma.
Right.
Because if we have a high opt-out rate and there are folks that are pushing back who are not in the classroom, who don't understand what's happening, their kids took assessments. I mean, assessments have been going on for a long time. They weren't the kind of assessments that are going on today. And there is a perception that it is the district's decision to have the kids opt out. And so it's a very difficult thing. Our position probably ought to be to look at whether we can come up with some better tests that kids believe in, for example, or that parents agree with. That's a better solution than this argument.
Ms. Goff and then Ms. Rankin.
Yeah, I...
these are good conversations.
Is there anything coming in to you all yet around the UIP and some statement about how districts are choosing to try to address a less than 95% participation rate? Now, I've got mixed feelings about that because on the one hand, that comes across as that's kind of wishy-washy. Mm-hmm. You know, do we either have a problem here or not? Are we meaning every layer of the system, are we intent on trying to rationalize the good, the bad, and the ugly about that 95% participation rate? It's a really rhetorical question in my mind right now. But I'd just be curious, and I think it might help to help to think that districts are going to talk about that. So if Boulder and if parts of Cherry Creek and other areas that had a rather high opt-out rate or spots within these districts, I don't know, there were some rurals that had some high rates considering the small size, but there were some that did not have a problem at all. So it doesn't matter where you talk about it. But to start looking at it more from the umbrella picture, what causes this? Where is the misperception, the miscommunication, the incorrect things that are getting spread around out there? But I just wonder if anybody has inched that in yet to discussions, whether it might be something to kind of bring out if we need to at these ESSA tour meetings. At the right moment or in the right connection to something else. It's upsetting because everybody's right and nobody's really all right, you know. I'm a little concerned about it. We're right in the middle of not knowing anything about how we did this year. Who knows? After the results actually come back, there will be another mood of the day. but I'm just curious about that.
Yes, Ms. Rankin.
I'd like to go back to what Dr. Shuffle said. You know, we only know what we know, and if we get that paper that has the facts on it, I think that is something we can pass out. I think that's an excellent example. And I also would like to have some bullet points, not of your whole presentation, but as you go, you're going to find more and more things are coming out that you hadn't thought about, but
absolutely,
you may be addressing. And the bullet points might be in the format of questions. Would you like to learn about, and just maybe four things that we can promote in our town halls, and then list the online site where they can go and register if they want to, you know, if they're busy and can't come to one of the meetings, and also say on the site, you can go to meetings that are listed. I think we need to promote people being educated about what we're talking about, and it sounds like we aren't even there yet, so...
Dr. Flores?
Well, I think
one of the things in Denver that people are talking about, and teachers and parents, is that the inordinate amount of time that is spent on practicing for these tests and time away from subject areas such as science and social civics, social science, all the other courses other than English, language arts, and math. That they're just not getting science, they're not getting history, they're not getting social studies, and that taking away the test time, taking away to practice on these, and that may not be the case in every.
So the purpose of this is to listen. We do listen to our constituents and share that here, but the purpose of this is to listen to some folks who often don't come to us. So I want to hear when you have a session in Denver that is the predominant conversation, as opposed to just only what we hear, because our constituents sometimes pick who they speak to or don't speak to us, but are much more comfortable coming and speaking.
Just a second there, let her finish.
So I just think this is about process, and this process is about opening up the schools we want, the concerns we have, to the broader community. And I'm anxious to hear what the differences are between the various regions, which is kind of one of the reasons I was talking about the wares. What is coming out of Denver? What is coming out of some of the other communities? They're very, very different.
Well, I was just telling you that I do go to these meetings where there are teachers who are very upset, there are parents who are very upset, and they are town hall meetings. There are meetings. It's not just all the volume of emails that I get or just talk, you know, one-on-one, but there are lots of
I'm not questioning that. Our topic is this particular process, so that's what we want to be hearing, is what folks are telling us.
But I agree, Dr. Schroeder, but I would say on this particular issue, if it comes up again, can we do everything we can to make sure that the state policy is understood and say out loud, there are no penalties that's going to accrue to anyone for not meeting 95%. And if we have to say it 10 times during the meeting, let's say it 10 times during the meeting, because the message's not getting through, and we get peppered with this stuff. I mean, I spend a whole week dealing with it. It's annoying.
Yeah.
Because it isn't as if we've left any gray in this. And this board's worked very hard not to leave any gray in this, and yet we have, and I have one charter school in Colorado Springs that was deliberately threatening parents for what I consider to be unsavory reasons.
Right.
And, I probably was less pleasant than usual with some of the administrators in that school. I just got tired of it. Don't make my phone ring. On something that we have acted on, we've done the best we can. And it's a charter school administrator's creating problems. That needs to stop.
That's a frustration that we feel.
And so I think of these meetings, if you the first time that comes up, just kill it. Yeah.
And I think I may have not presented this exactly right. I don't think people are confused about the policy. I think they understand what the policy is.
If they're still concerned they're going to be penalized, they don't understand the policy.
Okay.
Okay, please proceed.
Okay, so we talked about school improvement as well. There's some options in ESSA that we have that are different from how NCLB worked in terms of how school improvement funds are allocated to states and then how we can award them to districts. So there was a big question about one of the major things that is different is that with ESSA, 7% of our Title I allocation as a state is set aside for school improvement activities. And now instead of doing that as competitive grants, which we've done in the past, we can award that in a formula basis based on schools that are identified under the accountability system. So we were asking people, would they rather have formula or would they rather have competitive as we've done? And then we also asked what supports and services can CDE provide to help schools on improvement that have been identified. So we heard a lot, and we were in areas with smaller size districts for the most part. That there's a lot of feedback on having formula instead of competitive because of resources to do grant writing. There was a lot of positive support for doing it that way. They really liked an idea of having state provided menu of options that they could kind of opt into those supports, and they also see a role for the state in terms of connecting promising practices in schools and districts. In Junction, we heard a lot about how the small districts go to the larger districts out there, which is Grand Junction, which they're like, and then we go to take stuff from Jeffco and Denver, but how they get things from each other, and if the state could help with that facilitation of best practices or resource, they'd really appreciate it, because all the little ones are going to Junction, Junction's going to Jeffco or Denver to get things, and if we could help with that, they would like that.
So how can we help?
Yeah, I think that's something we'll have to think about, like how we can make sure, in terms of working with the districts and sharing best practices and connecting them with each other in areas that they're struggling.
Well, and I keep asking the question about why don't we have a BOCES system that provides that opportunity, and then I get the feedback that I get is that they are just so dramatically different, and there are districts that don't belong, but maybe there's an opportunity there that we haven't. Maybe we should find out why they don't belong or why they are so significantly different. Is it about money or is it about services or what is it about?
Yeah, my understanding of how the BOCES are organized, it tends to be some of the smaller districts all coming together and they'll work together on something, but they may not have connection to the larger districts because they're not in that BOCES. So if we can help facilitate the BOCES connections with each other and getting that work going, that might be a good way to be able to do it.
Any other questions? Going once?
Okay.
Go ahead.
So then another big area of conversation is around teacher qualifications and support. And you correct me. Colleen's not in the room. Colleen saved me there on this one. But there is a question because highly qualified is not in ESSA. That requirement for the match between the teacher's content area that they're instructing and that they have content knowledge in there. It's not in ESSA, and it reverts back to state law is what ESSA says, as we go with your state law requirements. And my understanding for the most part is state law requires a license, but not, and you need to have content when you get your license, but you could have a secondary science license, but that would, because you had a license, you could teach elementary school, and you wouldn't necessarily have the content. So there was a lot of conversation about we still need to report to the feds and to our public about teachers that are in and out of field and their experience levels and all of that, but how do we define that in field or that competency in Colorado, and do we want that? This is a bigger question because it has to do with state legislature too. There was a lot of different opinions about how to define competency. Is it 24 hours? Is it an endorsement? Is it a license? Is it all of those things? But there was also a very robust conversation about the challenge between teacher shortages and then wanting high-quality teachers. So people are really, the district spoke very personally about their recruiting efforts and what they're trying to, how hard it is for them to recruit some staff, especially in key areas like special ed. I heard about so many special education openings while we were out. But then wanting to make sure that there's still a level of quality with teachers, and just because we can't fill a position that we just lower expectations for what we have in the classroom. So there's a tension there. But it was a really good conversation to hear. And people are being really thoughtful about it. And then we also were asking questions about how should CDE provide help to provide effective instruction. Title I, Title III especially are about effective instruction for students that are most at risk. Title II to help support teachers helping students with those needs. And so what can CDE do in those areas? And we heard a lot from teachers, because we had a lot of teachers there, about more time for professional development, that really if we want to have all teachers be able to do all these things, they need some time to work together and do it, and they're just not finding that time during the day. It's not that they don't want to, it's just structure of the day. And we also heard about how important it is that teachers get direct learning.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, so when we talk about this issue, who is saying that, I mean, what's the prompt for this, actually?
I can show you the slide, and we'll send that out to you, but it's talking about how...
I can't believe teachers are showing up saying, if only we could show competency more or something. I mean, I can't believe parents are showing up saying, I don't think my teachers are competent. I wish that there were more tests that I could look at.
It's not about that. It's about really about with the highly qualified requirement going away without having that in place anymore, which has had that check for, you know, very well, checked for licensure and competency. but people felt some level of reassurance is what we heard when we were out, is that they liked knowing that, and there's cases that we also heard about where it's hard to fill positions, and then if you've got challenges there, and that's why it's looking at different ways of showing competency. But what I heard from people at the listening tour was really, we like to know that there is a content check as well as just having a basic level of license. And so not to say that we need something new, it's saying without highly qualified, we want to ensure that there's still some level of match between teacher content knowledge and the subject area they're teaching.
Wouldn't that be, isn't that the principal's job to make sure that the person, given that they're held accountable, wouldn't it be in their best interest to find teachers that are prepared to teach the courses that they're teaching?
Absolutely, and that came
so
up as well.
I hate to create more bureaucracy around
that. Totally, and so it could easily, and nobody was saying this has to be state law or state board policy or anything like that. They were just saying we value this, we value that teachers have that expertise in the content area that they're teaching in. How we go about doing that, where that is in policy or where it's not, if it's left up to the district or to the school on its own, that we didn't get to that point. It was just really this conversation of we value competency and quality in teachers. We know we have a teacher shortage. We know these two things are going to be hard to work through at the same time.
I have a question on that. So does that mean that highly qualified, where a teacher was responsible to have 36 hours in the content area, has that gone away?
The 24 hours or the degree or the endorsement, yes. That's not in ESSA when that gets implemented for 17-18 is the first full year of implementation. We don't have that highly qualified requirement. It says you follow your state law requirements.
Well, I thought we were progressing in this area. I really do think that teachers should have a specialty. I don't think that 54 hours of elementary or of education really does make a person competent. You have to, not that, I can see having lots of hours when you're out in the schools and maybe you get 6 hours for being out there all day long. But I think you need to have a degree of the areas that you're going to teach, English, and math or science. You need to have those 36 hours or whatever in those areas to be competent. And I don't think sufficing it with some of these courses in education, which is 54 hours, unless, again, they're out in the field. That means something. But not, I don't see how they could take that away.
I think Dr. Flores, I think the point has been made that that is no longer a federal requirement, and it's strictly the purview of the state legislature. And if we think there are changes to be made, they should be suggested to the legislature. And but absent that, the board has no.
Yeah.
Authority over this whatsoever.
Please
proceed.
We should work on that.
Sounds good. So just to let you know, adjustments that we made for future dates. We found that having small group discussion time before hearing individual comments really helped elicit conversation in the room. We tried a few different formats, but people felt much more comfortable after we kind of did a round of presentation. Then we had them talk small group, and then we had them come up for comments. We were videotaping the comments so that we can have an archival record of it all and really make sure we capture all of the comments and not just summarize like this. And so they felt they had really good, robust conversation at their table, and then they were willing to share out as a group, and then we had time so that they could share out as individuals, too, if they had additional points they wanted to bring up that were not necessarily common to the group or that they just wanted to share. We made some adjustments to the PowerPoint and the feedback forms. We're adding the future dates, and if you all have additional ones, please, you can email me, or actually if you email Dizzy, and then we'll get them from her, and Pat Chapman's office will work on that, and we're going to avoid shelter in place. That was enough of adventure.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a brief recess and reconvene promptly at 11 o'clock for the presentation of some awards.